Good morning, everyone. My name is Mike. I am an alcoholic. I talked to Don this morning down at the breakfast place, and he said, all we ask of you is that you don't embarrass yourself or your family. I said, I'll do my best. The chairman of the last meeting, I'm a little nervous, as you can tell, but I always say that anyway, because usually I am. And usually when I say it, I can stop hiding it. And once I stop hiding it, then I settle down and we get on with business. So and Tom had said last night, he was talking to one of the guys, that guy said, boy, I was really nervous. And Tom said, well, if it was anything else, I'd be worried about you. So I was talking to Tom this morning, he said, you got nothing to worry about. When I was asked, I got to tell you, first of all, the chairman of the last meeting had talked about saying something that he thought. He was afraid that people would say that he was saying what he was supposed to say. And I've been accused of a lot of things, but patronizing people is not one of them. I'll tell you that this, for me, has been a humbling weekend. And I choose the word carefully. I don't know when I have been in a room with so many givers at one time in a long time. This is just an incredible weekend for me. And I saw a lot of recovery here this weekend, you know, a lot of it. I had breakfast with a young guy the other morning, Rick, and who's getting out of the services, and he's sober a couple of years, I think it is, and he's moving back to Texas, and he's got a sponsor's name and a phone number in his pocket, and the first thing he's doing when he gets back there is to call that guy. And I listened to Wes at the participation is a Canadian word. At the participation meeting the other night, I heard Wes talk about going to see his sponsor who had cancer, who couldn't go to meetings anymore. And if you recall his words, if you heard them, he said, I dropped by to see how he was and to bring him the news about what was going on. And that's called caring for others. And you know, if you stop and think about one of the first things that happened to me when I came into our program, I'll get to that eventually, but one of the things that happened to me was I went to a meeting one night, and they were discussing the chapter on a vision for you. And I didn't understand what it was about. I didn't understand the discussion. I didn't understand what they were reading. And for once in my life, instead of shooting my mouth off, I went home and read A Vision for You. And by that time, I had a sponsor, and I went back to him, and I said, Bob, all I could get out of that chapter was, imagine getting better so that you could help somebody else get better. And he said, if you got that out of that chapter, you're doing okay. You hang in there, because that's what it's all about. And so what I heard the other night was somebody caring for somebody else. And what I've heard all weekend here was people caring for other people. And I think it was... I get the name mixed up. I don't know, it was Buddy or Ed. I can't recall the other night at the meeting where he was talking about being at that little 50-person minimum. And he said he was sober about 18 months, I think it was, when he started to go there. And he said he was feeling awful. And somebody brought him there. And he started to get outside of himself, you know. And one of my heroes in AA, and I hope you have some of your own, one of my heroes says that he would never rename alcoholism, but if he was going to do it, but he never would, he would call it self-centered isolation. And that, in fact, is the essence of our illness, you know, characterized by a lot of drinking. I think that this weekend has been such an eye-opener for me, and it brought to mind this story. I really will get to business in a second, so bear with me. Brought to mind this story. You know, I remember about 20 years ago, and I was studying at a university in Halifax, and I was studying with and working under probably one of the best human counselors. He was a human resource counselor in the province. They used to fly this guy all over the country in those days at about $500 a day. I mean, this guy was big news. And I was having some difficulties. I think he kind of had a hint that it might have something to do with the way I was drinking, but he was kind of not good enough to pick up on that one. Anyway, he said to me one day, he said, listen, take this card and write down your priorities. I said, okay, and I wrote down my priorities, you know, like my family, my work, my this, my that. So the guy looked at the card and he said to me, how come you're not on the card? And I went, oh. He said, do it again. So I filled it out again, and I put me on the card. And then he looked at the card again, and he said, is this what your priorities are, or is this what you think they ought to be? And I said, oh. He says, do it again. And I wrote down my real priorities. Work, 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 work. And maybe my family came about fifth or sixth, maybe. But what I'm trying to get to is that I identified who I was by what I did. And no more than that. And one of the things I've learned in North Carolina, really, in the last couple of years, because I've been fortunate enough to be here a few times, is that how many people there are in jail because of what they are. You know, I mean, they're sentenced because of what they do, but they're in jail because of what they are. We have a lot of people. I went back home 3 years ago after I came down here the first time. I went back home and I started to look at things in kind of a little bit different way. You know, we have about 1,400. I mean, that's not many by your standards, I know, but I work in the federal system in corrections in Canada. And we have about 1,400 inmates in our region, which is the Atlantic region. There's four provinces in our region. And I would dare say, I did a check one time, and I think something like 78% of them were either drunk or doing drugs or drinking when they did whatever it was they did. Now, I mean, I'm not that naive. A lot of guys are never going to change. But a significant percentage of those guys were like Rob was talking about the other night. He wasn't a car thief. He stole cars because he had to drink. You know, and a lot of our guys are in jail because they have to drink. They're not in jail because of what they do. It's because of what they are. You know, and I started to learn that. Interesting thing about that. The other thing I found out is if I want to get over being what I am, it depends on what I do. When I was first invited down here, I will get to business now. When I was first invited down here, my wife said, do you think they'll make fun of your accent? I said, eh? And then I came down and I heard Doug and I thought, no sweat. I only have a certain amount of time and I really want to share as much as I can and hope that it's of benefit to somebody here this morning. So I will get to it. I want to tell you just a little bit about what happened to me. I think we do share one thing. Your experience and mine is sometimes a little bit different in terms of your contribution to AA and what you do in AA. And you know, but our common bond is a recovery bond. There is nothing beyond that. You know, I found, this is my observation in my region, I can't speak about down here. I found down our way there's three kinds of people that go to institutions. And there are those that begin to experience the message of recovery, and they bring that inside. And there are those that go inside and begin to experience the message of recovery and bring it back out. And then in a very few cases that I know in our region, there are people that shouldn't be there, you know, who go in with the great message, we're going to save these guys. And what... is that not bondage itself? Is that not having the great message and looking down upon people and so on and so forth? And I think that whether we bring the message in or we win and learn it there or whatever, our bond outside and inside has to be recovery. I know that people do that in their own time. I know they get there in a lot of different ways. I know my way was weird. I mean, I didn't expect it to happen the way it happened. And God's got his own plan and a sense of humor. And the other thing I've learned in AA is that I heard a guy say this years ago, and it was so important to me, I've tried never to forget it. He said, like, AA is like a big banquet. He says, like a round table. And we sit at the table, and the table goes around, turns around. But you can only take off the table what you put on the table. So if you don't put very much on, you don't get very much off. He says, the good news is you can always change what you put on the table. That's one of the rules. And therefore, you can always change what you take off the table. I talked to a young guy this morning, really nice man, Tony. Don't want to embarrass anybody. We were talking, and he felt, you know, like he'd like to be doing more. He's working. He's sponsoring a group, and he'd like to be doing more. and God love them. Isn't that the words of recovery? I'd like to be doing more. I would like to grow more. I would like to take in more. It's a giving message. It's not a taking message, you know. And that's been the deal for me. I got to tell you a little bit about my drinking, a little bit about me. Talk about weird. Doug and I were talking for a second this morning, and I'm from New Brunswick. Now, every time I come down here, somebody says, Moncton, where's Moncton? Well, I'm going to tell you where Moncton is. It's 20 miles from Skidook. So if anybody in Raleigh stops and asks you how to get to Moncton, now you know. I originally came from Nova Scotia. President Clinton just spent a couple of days in Halifax, Nova Scotia at a summit conference there. And I was born in Nova Scotia. Nova Scotia is right on the East Coast, right on the Atlantic Ocean, and New Brunswick's the province right next to that. And Nova Scotia, the other word for that is New Scotland. So Doug and I share some heritage a little bit. And in Nova Scotia, there's a little island called Cape Breton. And that's where I was born. And I was going to say raised, but I'm not sure about that. Drug up anyway. And it's important to understand that. It's important for me to remember where I came from. In Cape Breton, it was a very industrial area back then. Mostly coal mines and in our town, the steel mill was the big industry. And my dad was a steel worker, and my uncles and my grandfather were coal miners, and there was a very close bond between the Catholic Church and the laborers, big time. The whole cooperative movement where people got together and started to save their own money and started to help each other grow and so on and so forth started in Cape Breton with the workers and the Catholic Church, as a matter of fact. So I grew up in that. I won't tell you what religion I was, but I was there. And my dad was an alcoholic, and he was violent when he drank. And he was remorseful when he didn't. None of us can relate to that. And he was about 5'4" or 5" or something like that. And I think almost every alcoholic I've ever met that's come from that kind of home, at one point in time has said, I will never be like that. I will never do that to the people that I care about. And that's what I said. My grandfather was a coal miner, and he's a great big guy, real nice man, very gentle and all that. And I thought, that's the guy I want to be like. Now, the problem is, I always wanted to be like him and him and him and him and everybody else. I heard Tom talk about it a lot of times, a hole in the soul, you know. There was just something missing. Almost everybody in AA that I've ever talked to talks about that. There was just something missing. And I didn't quite know what it was. Didn't even know that it was missing, as a matter of fact. I just felt kind of different. Until I was 15. And that was the day I had my first drink. And I had heard this described this way one time, and it fits so perfectly that I've never forgotten that either. It was like, I mean, I didn't get drunk, and I didn't get sick, and I didn't get in a fight, and there was nothing spectacular about the first day I drank. But it was like there was a whole bunch of screws loose, and somebody just come up behind me and just tightened them all up. And I felt wonderful. My first sponsor used to say that this was a feelings disease. God, I used to hate it when he'd say that. I used to that just, until the day he said, because the day I drank, it felt better. In hindsight, I used to hear guys come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and they'd say, I was an alcoholic the first day I drank. And I would say, well, too bad for you. I had fun. But you know, in hindsight, since I've gone, you know, started to involve myself in the process of recovery, I was an alcoholic from the first day I drank, because I started to change that day. I didn't see it happening. I just started to change. Now, here's some of the things I found out when I eventually did my inventory. When I was 15, I couldn't swim. When I was 18, I taught it. When I was 15, I used to play ball a little bit. When I was 19, I pitched and won. I didn't play football at all. When I was 20, I quarterbacked and won. And I never saw the connection at all. You know, I thought, starting to get some independence here, you know. What I had started to get was some arrogance, was what I had started to get. I got that determination that very few people have other than alcoholics. Well, I told you that you know, really interesting. We live in contrast. You know, I went to St. Evex University, which is the big Catholic university in the Maritimes, one of the big ones. It's kind of a pretty neat place. And they really try to get guys to be priests in that place, you know. And so I did two things. One, I told everybody I wanted to become a priest, and then I got to go out with the richest girl in town because her mother would feed you and her father drank a lot. So I would come stumbling back onto campus about 1 o'clock in the morning, and the priests would be coming out of their recreation area that they had, and they would see me going back to the residence. You know, it never ever dawned on me that they were coming out of there at 1 o'clock in the morning, too. So I used to think they're going to find out about me. But anyway, being a man of no particular moral character, I decided to become a priest. And really, here's the way it came down to. In our area, in my home parish, one year, we had 10 young guys who were ordained priests. 10 in one parish. They were all young. They were all athletic. They were all really good role models. They used to work with us, coaching us hockey and ball and all that kind of stuff. They were great guys. They had a lot of respect. And if you want to get a lot of respect, why not? Why not do that? So I did. Still got the coat. Not quite. Not quite. So I went off and did that for a little while. Went to study. Made big, big marks. And it was really interesting because a lot of things happened. I won't bore you with my drinking history. It's the same as everybody else's. There was a lot of disasters. Almost got thrown out of the seminary because we went drinking one day. Two other guys did. Bad news was I was the one that started the party. And anyway, I got through with that and got ordained, believe it or not. Now, the first parish I went to, it was down in the country with this other guy who was in charge of the thing. And the first day I got there, he had this barbecue. And he had invited a bunch of people, including his cousin. She's the most beautiful nun I ever saw in my whole life. And I should have figured there was something wrong with my attitude starting right about then, you know. What happened? I didn't do anything about that, by the way. But anyway. But what I started to do almost immediately was, I would get up at 6 o'clock in the morning, I would work every day till about 11 o'clock at night, and then I would go back to where we lived and I would drink. Almost from the very beginning. And that started just a real downhill. I was just so unhappy, it was just incredible. And so after 3 or 4 years, I decided, like, this is not the place for me to be. So I left and I went back to school again. And then I got hired after I got my master's degree, I went and got hired in corrections. And I hated that job. I mean, I only took the job because I needed a job. And that was the only one available. And the interesting thing that happened was I started to get promoted really quick. I was one of those guys. I didn't like the place. I was afraid of the place. And I thought, if you're going to be afraid of this place, or if you don't want to be afraid of this place, you better get out into the middle of it. So I would run the ranges and run the yards and do this and do that. And a lot of guys wouldn't do that. So because I did it, I started to get promoted. And I was a couple of years, I was assistant warden of the place. And I was there. I stayed there 3.5-4 years, and then I left and went with another department for a year, and then I come back. And they were having a lot of trouble in that particular jail, a lot of trouble. There was a lot of drugs. There was a lot of assaults and stabbings and escapes. And, oh, it was just a mess. So my boss asked me if I would go back down there again and see if I could help whoever was there straighten it out. So everything in my mind said, don't do this. My mouth said yes. And by this time, people knew that I had a drinking problem. But I was one of those guys, by the way, who thought, I mean, I put so much energy into trying to control it and manage it. It was just incredible. And one of the guys said yesterday, and he would stop for periods of time. You know, I would stop for periods of time. And everybody would think, he's okay now. So I went back down there. I was down there about 2 months. They made me the warden of the place. You know? You think we're the only ones sick, right? Guess what? And I immediately, I mean, it was in bad shape. And so I did what alcoholics do. I'm going to fix it. And I would show up there at 7 in the morning, and I would work till 6 or 7 at night, 6 days a week. And on the way home, I would stop at the bar, and I would stay there till 10 o'clock or 11 o'clock. I would go home. I would go to sleep. I would get up hungover. and I would go and do it again. You know the kind of energy that goes into that kind of formula, right? I was there for a while. I mean, we got the place straightened out a little bit in spite of me. But one of the guys came to me and they said, Mike, people are talking about you. I said, what do you mean? Well, they say you drink too much. And I did what I had always done. You know, when I was a priest one time, a little kid came to me, 15 years old, beautiful, beautiful little girl, came to me. She says, Mike, people are talking about you. So why? She said, you drink too much. You know what my response was? Thanks a lot. And then I put up a wall between me and that kid. I wasn't rude to her or anything like that. I just stayed away from her and anybody that she had anything to do with. A fella came to me in the pen and said, Mike, you're drinking too much. You know what I did? Put up the wall, and I started to hide it more, is all I did. You know that sense of incomprehensible demoralization they talk about in the book. And Robbie talked about it the other day. He looked in the mirror and he hated himself. And I would look in the mirror and people would say, you're really something else. And I would look and I just hate me. I just despised me. I went to see my boss and I told him, he said, I think you should take me out of there. Now, over the years when I had been working at that place, I had made a lot of requests. For some reason, he responded to that one quicker than any I had ever made before. I asked one day, I was gone the next. And then there was this kind of a whole series of them trying to get me better. At that point in time, went to Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I wish I could tell you that I was one of those guys that came into Alcoholics Anonymous and got well, but I wasn't. There was not in our community, I hate to say it, but at that point in time, there was not in our community a great tradition of recovery. There was not a strong network of sponsors and sponsees. There was not a whole lot of step work going on. There was not a whole lot of service going on. I way back then, I went to one of those service meetings. God, I come out of there, I was so mad I could spit nickels, you know? God, I was just like that coming out of there because it was all personalities and it was ego and it was power and it was all that stuff, you know? It was just hateful. But anyway, I wasn't anywhere near ready for recovery anyway. And so my bosses would say to me, look, Mike, and in fact, this is what they said to me. You know, Luke, you're a really smart guy. And we like you. And we think we're underutilizing you. So guess what? If you can control your drinking for a year, we'll promote you. I said, watch me. Watch me. So I went on the wagon. I went on the wagon. I didn't drink for a year. And they were good to their word. 1 year later, they promoted me again. And 6 months later, I was drunk again. And that story just goes on and on. I mean, I could bore you for the next 2 hours about just the constant over and over and over again sequence of that, you know? My family obviously wasn't going all that well in the course of this whole thing. I had gotten married to one poor victim, and we had a little boy, Kevin, and Kevin was just, when Kevin was born, there was that magic there, you know? Kevin and I just clicked. And I swore to God that I would be the best father that ever walked the face of this earth. This kid's got it made. And there will be no violence in our family. Okay? Now, the only thing I didn't do was physically beat them up. I didn't do that. But God, that tongue, eh? You know? I lashed them into the ground, my wife and Kevin and my next kid, and didn't even want to do it. Just did it. And when I wasn't shooting my mouth off, I wasn't saying anything. And obviously, you know, marriages don't do very well in that kind of an environment. And it was only a matter of time before that one went down the tubes, you know. While all this is going on, I'd gone to Alcoholics Anonymous, like I said. One time I stayed sober 8 months, then it was a year and a half, then it was 2.5 years. Now let me tell you about the last drink, because it's really what I want to get to. On about August the 25th, 1988, I woke up one morning, and I promise you that my opening thought of the day, the very first thing I thought of that day, was, I have two priorities in this life today. My wife, this is my second wife, and my little baby, who at that time was 2 years old. That was my opening thought of the day. At 9:30 in the morning, my finger was in my wife's face, and I was saying, you bitch. you should be in a few adjectives, nut house. You need a bloody psychiatrist. I mean, I was just vile. And while that was going on, I was thinking, what am I doing? Honest to God, I mean, I was like this, and it was just coming out of me. And I didn't understand it. That little boy who was 2 years old was looking at me. He had that fear in his eyes that I never, ever wanted to see in a child, ever. And I was so angry, hurt, scared, terrified. I can't put a name on it to this day. I'll tell you what I know, though. The only thing that would fix it was to go out and drink. I had been dry at that point in time, a year and a half. I couldn't understand why I had to drink again. I didn't know. I just knew I had to. I was either going to commit suicide, go crazy, or kill her. And since I didn't have enough jam to do any of them, I had to go and drink, and that's what I did. I only drank for 10 days that time, but I caused more havoc in those 10 days than you would ever want to believe. It was just incredible. I went back to 8 hours after, no, about 12 hours after I drank that night, I was in trouble at work again. Surprise, surprise, I went in the next morning, somebody smelled booze. By noontime, I was in the boss's office. And he said, and he confronted me, he says, we have that problem again. And I did what we always do, you know. I said, who in the hell do you think you are? What I do in my time is my business. And I was scared, and he had me. And I figured, we're not paranoid types, you know that. I figured, he's got me, finally. I got to get out of here. So I told him, I got a doctor's appointment. I want to talk to you some more. I said, are you trying to tell me I can't go to the doctor? And he kind of looked at me and he said, well, no. I said, bye. Choom. I'm gone. And then I stayed drunk for 9 days. The miracle of AA began to happen to me at that point in time. This is really important for me. I was drunk about 8 days. And my wife, now, you know, every now and then you run into Al-Anon bashers in various circles. I haven't heard any of it here, thank God. But every now and then you run into that, you know. And I want you to know, this one's not an Al-Anon basher. My wife had already gone to Al-Anon. And she had gotten a sponsor, and she had started her steps. And I was about 3 o'clock in the morning drunk. And there was a jug on the table and all that kind of stuff. And I did what we all do, you know, the eternal prayer of the alcoholic. God help me. Now, God help me meant, because I really wanted to die. God help me for me meant this. God, let me stop drinking. Let me wake up in the morning. Let me not be hungover and let me not drink anymore. Only God's got his own agenda going at this point in time. My wife walked in, the same one that I had been screaming at 8 days earlier. And I said to her, you know, you realize in my self-pity and all that kind of stuff, I said, you realize that I've probably lost my job, eh? And I really expected her to say, and we have to leave too. You know, I just didn't expect anybody to have to put up with that or to put up with me. I just didn't expect that. What she said was, don't you realize that that's part of your powerlessness? And I said, what? I didn't know what she meant, but I knew it was true. I didn't know what she meant, but I knew it was true. And so I went back, I went to treatment. Now, I went to treatment the second time. The first time I went to treatment had been 3 years earlier or something like that. I'll tell you what happened to me very quickly, the first time in treatment. They showed a film on the physical makeup of alcoholism. You know, on the whole extra drugs and the dopamine and all that kind of stuff. They showed that stuff. And I thought, oh, because I had gone over there, like, why me, why me, why me? They showed this film, and I said, oh, now I understand. Now that I understand, I don't have to drink anymore. And they would have the groups, and I would lead the groups. I did what I always did. I led the groups. I'd be in the discussion groups, and I'd be saying just profound things all over the place, you know. And then I went home, thinking that now that I understand, I don't have to drink anymore. I found myself back in treatment 3 days later after my wife had said that. It was just miraculous how it happened. It was just hard to get into it, but it just happened. The interesting thing was I found myself in the same bed that I had been in 3 years previously, in the same room, on the same floor, with the same people. I was sick. I was really sick. And they made us go, you know, after they kind of dried us out a little bit, they made us go to a couple of AA meetings. And there had been a guy in treatment with me who was there the first time. He was fried. God, he was drinking and he was taking all kinds of drugs and all kinds of stuff. And he was just fried. And they kept him longer in detox than they had kept us and so on and so forth. And God, they took us out to the meeting and he was the speaker. And he looked so good. And I felt so sick. And I'm sitting in the front row, like, you know, with my head down. And this guy is saying, you know, he said, I was so sick when I was in treatment last time. He said, I knew I was going to die. So he said, I asked so-and-so what I had to do. And she said, I had to learn to take direction. And he said, and that's all I did. I learned to take direction. And I'm sitting there, I think, God, there's got to be more to it than that. It just can't be that simple, you know. So I kind of hung in there for a little bit. I was still in detox, like I said. And I want you to hear my alcoholism. Here's my alcoholism. It's not the drinking, okay? Here's my alcoholism. I had almost destroyed a second family. I was on the verge of losing my job. I was on the verge of physically dying. They brought some AA members into the treatment center. In fact, everybody that worked there was a member of AA, as a matter of fact. And a couple of guys really got to me, and they said to me, Mike, when you went home the last time, what did you do? And I said, well, what do you mean, what did I do? Well, did you get a group? Well, no. Did you get a sponsor? No. Did you read the book? No. Did you do the steps? No. Well, the guy said, it's easy. Why did you drink? He said, you didn't do anything. So, you know, what would you expect, you know? And I said, oh. That's the most profound thing I said for 2 years. Oh. We get into this debate. I was there. It took them about 15 days to get me just to stop vibrating a little bit. And we had this big discussion. I had a meeting with the doctor who was running the treatment center. And she was in recovery. She was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you want to hear my alcoholism, here it comes. I had spent a lot of time with those guys. And they had said to me, you didn't do anything when you went home. And if you didn't do anything, you're not going to get anything. Nothing's going to change. If you don't change what you do, you're not going to change what you are. I said, yeah, you're right. So we had this meeting set up. And the meeting was with me and the doctor. And I said, whatever she wants me to do, that's what I'm going to do. If she wants me to stay here for the treatment all over again, that's what I'm going to do. And if she wants me to go home and do all the things in AA that I didn't do before, that's what I'm going to do. But whatever it is she wants me to do, that's what I'm going to do. I walked in the door. She said, Mike, how are you doing? I said, fine. We want you to stay. I'm going home. Just like that. I'm going home. And she said one of the most important things that has ever been said to me. Because I was sitting there arguing with her, and at the same time my mouth was going, my head was saying, what are you doing? I mean, I knew it was insane. She said, the problem with you is you're not thinking right, and you're not feeling right, and you don't even know it. And you're going to go home, and they're going to eat you alive. And I said, oh. Somehow or other, I didn't know what she was talking about, but I knew that she was right. I just knew it. So I stayed. A lot of people said a lot of things to me in treatment. They were all AA guys that said it, you know. I kept saying, like, I don't understand why you can't get this program. I had been at it for 8 years. I was in and out and in and out of AA for 8 years. You know, you don't ever have to do that. I'm here to tell you. But that's what I did. I didn't understand why I couldn't seem to catch on what was going on. And some brilliant AA guy said to me, Mike, do you realize that you can't understand everything? I said, what? Now, I didn't know that I really thought I was supposed to understand everything until I reacted like that. And I said, no, I didn't know that. And he said, well, that's the way it is. He says, you know, Mike, you've been around a little bit. He says, you've been, you know, like, your previous occupation, he says, you kind of hung around a church a little bit. He says, do you believe in God? I said, well, yeah. He said, do you believe that God of your understanding cares for you? And my answer was, I don't know how he could. I had no idea how he could. And that's when I started to understand just how much I hated me. I just thought I had nothing, was nothing, and would never be nothing. And so I was committing suicide on the installment plan. That's what happened. They made me promise to get a sponsor when I went home. And I did that. I was home about 2 months. I got a sponsor, and I you know what I did? God, we're crazy. I went home, and I got the sponsor who came to visit me in the treatment center and told me what a nice guy that I was. That's the sponsor for me. The good news was he was a traveling salesman. I could never see him. And within a month, I started to go crazy again. There was one guy in treatment, one AA member, who was just a fine, fine man. And our book says, you know, his whole department shouted that he knew what he was talking about. I just knew that he knew. I had never heard that kind of stuff before that he was saying. And it was so simple, and it was so straightforward. And I go home, and I get a sponsor who was going to be nice to me, and I can't see him. And I ran into this other guy who was saying exactly the same thing that Donnie was saying on the island. And his name was Bob, and I knew that I needed, and I promised to get I was going to get a sponsor, and I knew I needed a sponsor. And I asked Bob to be my sponsor. Do you want to hear my alcoholism? Bob, will you be my sponsor? Yes, Mike. He says, now I want you to know I got clay feet. I talk better than I walk. But he says, I'll be your sponsor. I said, good, Bob. Now, Bob, it's time for us to do the fourth step. That's my alcoholism. And he said to me, no, Mike, he says, I think we'll start with, like where everybody else starts. He said, we'll start with step one. Because he said, you don't know anything. I couldn't believe that he'd say that to me. You don't know anything. Now, Bob was about 5'4", about the same size as my father in hindsight. We had this little game we would play after a while, you know. I'm about 6 feet and he's 5'4". And every time he'd tell me something I didn't want to hear, I'd stand right close to him and look down. And he'd tell me to sit down. And I'd tell him to stand up. And then I'd do what he'd tell me to do. And he said, Mike, you don't know anything. But he said, that's good. That's good. You don't have to know anything because I'm going to take you by the hand and I'm going to walk with you through the steps of recovery as my sponsor walked through them with me. And you don't have to know anything. There was this weight came off my shoulders. I'm dead serious. It was like, first time I ever experienced any of that consciously. It was just like, whew, I can stop figuring it out. And I started to do with him what I had been incapable of doing before. Now, I don't intend to go through the steps. You don't need to hear that from me. But let me tell you just one or two of the things I learned along the way about the steps, about me and the steps. I learned that I really didn't know anything. You know, I got the why question answered. I think the why question is such a dumb question because once you get the answer, so what? You know, why me? Who cares? Doesn't matter. You got to do something about it, right? I found out in step one that the why was because I couldn't handle life. Every time I had a set of expectations, I would build them up to here. And if I would get there, they weren't good enough. And if I was afraid I wasn't going to get there, I would get all tensed out or whatever. Whatever it was, when I couldn't stand the environment, I would get drunk. Well, I'll tell you what I found out in step two. Somebody said to me, well, here I am with all kinds of degrees in theology and everything else like that. Guy says to me, you need a simpler version of a higher power. He said, you know that two people is more powerful than one? I said, oh, okay. That's true. You know, I never thought of it that way before. I always wanted the big picture. I always wanted, it was so mysterious. My whole upbringing was, there was this God up there, and he was so big and majestic. Wasn't fearful. I was never taught that. I never taught that. It was so big and far away and mysterious that I couldn't relate. And somebody said to me, you know, two people is four times stronger than one person dying alone. And I got to step three, and Bob says, you know what the decision is in step three? And I said, what? He said, to do the rest of the steps. I said, oh? I mean, I'm dead serious. In that 8 years, I thought I had done the third step three or four times. I would nail this hand up on the cross and then I would try and get, how am I going to nail that one up, you know? So I'd have to take the nail out and go get drunk again because it hurt. So I made that decision and I did the steps. with Bob. I did a lot of things I didn't want to do. I really did a lot of things I didn't want to do. Things started to go well for me. I got to tell you one more side story, because this is very important. Just when I got Bob as my sponsor, just then, I want you to know, I came into Alcoholics Anonymous again the second time terrified. I was absolutely certain that I was going to drink again. That's all I had ever done. I'm going to drink again. I'm going to screw up. I'm going to mess up my family. I'm going to lose my job. It's going to happen. I know it's going to happen. My boss called me in. You know, I get home from treatment. You think I just went back to work? Oh, Mike, we're glad you're back, right? He calls me in. I had still not started the process of recovery. He said, we've had enough of this. I said, have you now? I've been to the lawyer. And I stuck my finger in his face and said, you do what you got to do, and I'll do what I got to do, and we'll see who wins this one. And then I put it in a letter to him. And then I sent a copy of the letter to his boss so he would know what kind of a jerk he had working for him. He did. Me. That's what I did. He wasn't impressed with my noise. He wasn't impressed with my noise at all. And he said to me, the very best thing that can happen to you, he says, if you find a rock to hide under for about 2 years maybe, you might have a job at the other end of this. Maybe. And he said that to a guy who really, when you get down to it, was convinced, I'm going to screw up again. He said, you go work in Reynosa, which is a maximum security jail about 90 miles up the road. He says, you should go hide there for a couple of years. And somehow or other, I knew he was right. Somehow or other. So I started going up there. And I started listening to tapes. I was so scared of getting drunk again that I started listening to tapes. And I heard a bunch of things. They had told me in the island, you want to get well? Join a group, get a book, read the book, get a sponsor, do your steps. On my tapes. I was driving up the road one day, and I heard a guy say, do you want to get well? Join a group and contribute. Get a sponsor and do what he says. Get a book and read it. Do your steps. Pray in the morning, pray at night. And I thought, funny, I heard that. I haven't heard that before in 8 years. I hear that twice now in the last month. When I went to see Bob, Bob said, when he said to me, yeah, I'll be your sponsor, he said, here's what we're going to do, Mike. You're going to join the group and contribute and get a book and read it. And I'm going to be your sponsor. You can do what I tell you, and you're going to do your steps and pray in the morning and pray at night. And I thought, there was a weird recurring theme to this whole thing, you know. Must be a message here somewhere. The other thing I heard, which is the most important thing for me, going up in that car, and you got to remember the state of mind I was in at that point in time. I was really demoralized. I mean, I was just awful. And I heard a tape, and somehow or other I believed this. I was listening to the tape, and the tape said, you deserve the best in sobriety. He was talking about himself. I deserve the best in sobriety. I will go around, over, through anybody or anything that keeps me from the very best in sobriety. And somehow or other, I believed that too. So that stuck. I just thought, you're right. You've always settled for second best. There's something to recovery you don't understand, and all you've ever settled for is not drinking. There's got to be more to this than that. I went up there, and I would work at that jail, and I would be working in this office there, and I would be just overwhelmed with fear. Just waves over me, you know. And I would think, you're going to get drunk, you're going to lose your family, you're going to lose your job, and all that kind of stuff. Somebody had given me a little card with all kinds of little topics on it and references in the big book, and I looked up fear. And it says, fear, page 68. I go to page 68. I'm sitting in this office just feeling awful, just feeling terrified. And it looks at fear, and it says, we ask him to take away our fear and direct our attention to what he would have us be. And I thought, yeah, that's right. All I can be today is what I can be. I can only be my best today. There's nothing more than that. And you know, funny thing would happen. The fear would go away for that moment. And somehow I would start to focus on the day. Like I'm worried about getting fired tomorrow, drinking tomorrow, losing my family tomorrow. And I started to focus on today. Went through that, started that process with Bob, and things started to happen to me. I tell you what I found out in steps 1, 2, and 3. I was about 8 months sober, and my boss called me in the office, and I thought, here it comes. He closed the door. called me down from Reno. So you come on down here. We want to talk to you. Called me in, closed the door, and I thought, here comes the other shoe. They finally figured out how they're going to do it. Sit down, Mike. I sat down. He said, Mike, people can't believe the change in you. He said, it's incredible. Here's three jobs. Which one do you want? I said, I'll keep doing the one I'm doing. Thank you. And I stayed doing what I was doing. I didn't see any change in me. All I saw in me was a scared, terrified, onshore, stumbling, arrogant person just trying to get along, just trying to stay sober today. That's all I saw. And he said, people can't believe the change in you. Bob had told me that that's what was going to happen. I really didn't see any change in me. Boy, I'll tell you, you know, God gives us a pat in the butt every now and then just to keep us going. And all of a sudden, I just got just a little bit more courage to go ahead with what I was afraid of, which was my steps. I found out that I lived. My Bob says to me, you know, time to get down to causes and conditions, Mike. I was too embarrassed to tell him. I didn't understand what he meant by condition. Let's get down to the causes of my anger, my fear, my this, my that. Yeah, yeah. Condition, I don't understand. By the time I wrote that step out, and I'll tell you something, I did it as good as I could. I knew it wasn't perfect, but boy, I did it as good as I could. And I found out that I lived in a condition of anger, and I lived in a condition of fear. I wasn't angry at you or him or her. I was angry. I was afraid of everything. I was afraid of success and failure at the same time. There's a winner. You know? God. I was afraid you'd care about me and that you wouldn't. That you'd love me and that you wouldn't. Talk about your walls, eh? I found out about that. And then I got another surprise in step five. I was terrified to go see this guy. I went and saw this priest. He's a priest in, fine man. Has been in AA about 30 years and a priest about 10 years. He was a late vocation. He got sober in AA and kept working for 20 years, became a priest. And he's just one of the finest men you ever want to meet. And I went in and I spilled my guts. It embarrasses me to tell you. He listened to me go on for 2 days. I mean, oh, I get blushed when I think about it. I went on and on and on and on. I just spilled it. And you know what? I come out of there with the realization that for the first time in my life, I had been honest with somebody. I never knew that before. If you had said to me, are you an honest person? I would say, like, I don't lie. I would have said that. I mean, I would have been lying, but I would have said it. And I would have meant it. You know, somebody over the weekend said, you know, when Sue was saying, when Keith said he was sorry or that he was going to, he meant it. And I walked out of Brady's office and I said, God, I have been honest for the first time in my life. It's a brand new experience. It just blew my mind. Just absolutely blew my mind. And then I came to a screaming halt in my steps. One of the things that happened along the way was this. Bob said to me, I was bragging to Bob. Bob was a great guy. I mean, he used to give me a tap in the head every now and then, but it was like pretty gentle, you know. And I was bragging to him one day, and I said, Bob, you know, I've been going to AA for in and out for a lot of years now, and I hear people saying, you know, I thank God every morning and every night. And I said, I've never been able to do that. I never remember. But you know what, Bob? I've been doing that this time, especially on the good days. And he said to me, you do it especially on the bad days, because those are the growing days. You just don't understand that yet. So I remember the first time I got into bed one night, and I had this awful day. It was just lousy. And I got into bed, and I said, God, now this is the way it went. I swear to God, this is word for word. This is my prayer. God, Bob says that I got to thank you. This has been a really lousy day. What the hell am I thanking you for? I mean, I don't know what I'm thanking you for. But Bob says I got to do it. So I guess I got to do it, even though I don't think I mean it. So, thanks a lot. And that is exactly the prayer I said. And do you know what the miracle of that was? By noontime the next day, I knew exactly what had gone on that day. I saw clearly what had gone on. I saw where my ego had gotten involved. I saw where I was trying to shove people around, didn't even see it. I saw all that. And I thought, wow, this is really something. I can't tell you how many times that's happened to me. It's incredible. I went and did a presentation, I don't know, a year ago. And to our executive committee, and it was good work, let me tell you. Always is. Whether you think so or not. No, it really was pretty good work. I mean, they blew me out of the water. It was incredible. I walked out of there, I was angry. I was upset. I was just bouncing. You know, those unappreciative SOBs, how dare they talk to a star like me, like that. Went to bed that night and I said, God, there's another one in those days. I still don't know if I believe it. But thanks. Tom and Wallace and a couple of guys know my dog. I get this really neat dog. He's an Alaskan Husky. I think he's psychic or something. Every time I have a bad day, he comes about 5 o'clock in the morning. He starts beating on me to get up so I can do my readings and all that stuff. He really does. He comes beating on me in the morning, get up. I had said thank you the night before. I get out of bed. And by the time I hit the bedroom door, here's the truth of it. You were sucking up. You did this presentation in such a way that they would think you were wonderful, and that they would think you're wonderful, you will get what you want. That's called sucking up, face up to it. And that was the truth of the matter. And I knew it. I went to see my boss that morning. Guess what, boss? What? I was sucking up. I said, and therefore, I didn't do my homework right. And therefore, I didn't give you the information you needed. He said, well, give it to me now. So I gave it to him. He said, good idea, let's do it. You know, I slowly started to get honest in our program. I came to a screaming halt in step 6. For 2 months, I didn't do anything. I did nothing. And I got scared again. And I was sitting, I was sitting one morning, about 6:30 in the morning, I was sitting there and I was saying, geez, you know, like, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? And Bob had talked to me along the way, and somewhere or other, he said, procrastination is fear-based. If you stop doing your steps, you're afraid of something. And I had been really trying. I had read the book. I'd run over town. I talked to Bob about it and so on and so forth, but I couldn't take that step. And I sat there and I said, and Bob's words came through to me. And I said, I'm at step 6 and I'm afraid. Of what? And the truth came out. I'm afraid that if I ask him to take away my defects, he will. And then what am I going to do? Then what will become of me? I liked them. So I said this prayer. I said, God, here's the way it is. I don't want you to take away my defects. I like them. I can control people with my anger. And that lust one, well, we won't even talk about that one, God, but that's neat. I like that one. We just hang on that one anyway. I'm afraid that what happens to me when you take away those defects. I'm afraid of that. I don't know if I'm going to express this very well or not. This thought came, I don't hear voices, okay? But I tell you what happens a lot of times in moments of meditation. There is a thought that drowns out all other thought, if that makes an ounce of sense to you. And one of the thing that came to my mind that day was this. But my defects are objectionable and they're going to kill me. It was the only thought in my mind. Do you know that a year later I was reading Joe McHugh's book on the steps we took, you know? And when I read in that book, you know, we come to understand that our defects are objectionable to others. I thought, wow, that's exactly what happened to me, precisely, you know? But that's what happened that day. But they're killing me and they're objectionable to others. So God, guess what? I don't want you to take away my defects. But I'm willing that you do. And I found out that willing and wanting were two different things. And that I could be willing for recovery to happen, knowing that my illness will want me to stay sick. And I did my 7th with my sponsor the next day. And I went on to make my amends. And I'm just going to tell you one amends story because it was a miracle to me. I'll tell you two of them. I'm hesitant to tell you the second one. But anyway. Lord. I got to make my amends, and I was really afraid of the dreaded ex-wife. I mean, she had license to kill, you know. I mean, I was not a nice person to this lady. She wasn't a nice person to me either, but I mean, God help her. Why would she want to be, you know? And I had to go and make amends to her. And I stopped at step 9. And I, same thing, I was afraid. And it was pointed out to me that what you're afraid of, he says, what are you afraid of? You know, what are you afraid of making that amends? I said, well, here's what she's going to do. And it was pointed out to me that only God can know the future. You're predicting the future. Therefore, you're playing God again. I thought, you're right. I got to make the amends. I called her up. I had to pray for the strength and the courage to push the numbers on the phone, not to make the amends. So I pushed the number on the phone, and his beady little voice on the other end says, yes. Can I go see you? Why? I need to talk to you. Okay. And I went, okay, and I sat down with her, and I told her about how I thought and felt when I started to drink. I told her about how I had changed. I told her about my behavior. I told her what I had done to her. I told her it was wrong. And I told her I had never wanted that for her. And I didn't. And she sat there with her mouth open, hanging open. And her response was, maybe we can have a less angry relationship. And I thought, wow, what a winner. And I went on to make a whole bunch of those amends. And I was sitting there one morning, and this is the way it happened too. I was sitting one morning doing my meditation and stuff, and boy, it was going great, and I was feeling good and all that kind of stuff. And I said, God, who's next today? You know, you talk about cocky, eh? Who's next? And I don't know why I did it to this day. I swear to God, I don't. I don't know why I did it. I get up, and I walked into my bedroom, and I opened this briefcase that I hadn't opened for a long time. I don't know why I did it yet. And these papers came floating down. And I picked up the papers. It was that letter I wrote to my boss way back then. And I read the letter. And my God, what a sick, sick boy I had been. What a sick boy I had been. But the good news was, and this is what's happened to me in recovery, I get to recognize the good instead of get hung up on the bad a lot of times. I recognized how sick. I could see how sick I was. I had been. I couldn't see that a year and a half before that. I was incapable of seeing that. And I thought, oh my God, you know. A whole bunch of things happened to me right then that would take too much time to go into, but I understood at a particular moment why those steps are in the order that they're in for me. I went from there to there in a heartbeat. I just understood how they fit on me. I understood. Funny how things will come to you. You know, on page 26 in the book, there is a solution. But none of us like the leveling of pride. That's the line that came to me. I understood exactly what that meant, because I bet you I had done 1,500 things in a year and a half I didn't want to do. There were recovery decisions I had to make because I didn't have any other choice. It's all as good as it had to be. And I understood that clearly, and I understood that God was doing for me what I couldn't do for me for 8 years, trying to power my own recovery. I understood that. I just want to very quickly tell you about the last couple of years, and then Boy, when I get talking, time flies for me. I know about you. I was fortunate enough to come down here 3 years ago. I must tell you one other event that happened in my life. You know, when I first started to get well, we had a conference in Moncton, 20 miles from Skidook. And the guy who was chairing the conference said, look, there's this guy coming from North Carolina. We want him to come up a day early and speak at one of the institutions. And he says, you know, you work in the business, so can he stay at your house the extra night? And I said, jeez, you know, I suppose, you know. And anyway, Tom came up. stayed at my house, and we sat up till 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, and I don't remember yet to what we talked about. But I started, and I don't want to embarrass Tom, or I don't want to do anything like that, I started to form my picture of what the best in sobriety looked like. We need models. We need models. And we sat there, and I thought, boy, that's what I want. It's that kind of sobriety that I want. And the funniest thing about that, because after that, I started to meet a lot of people who really went after the best in sobriety, you know. I was fortunate enough to come down for Tom's anniversary, 35th anniversary, three years ago. And my organization paid the bill for me to come, by the way. And part of the deal was we had to run around to a bunch of the institutions and see what kind of programs they were putting on. Now, I still work in operations. I don't work in treatment. In our region, I'm kind of working the whole case management, security stuff, and all that. But because I worked directly with the operational part of it, they wanted to see within operations how folks down here were doing treatment. So we went to a whole bunch of institutions. And I want you to know that was one of the most incredible experiences of my life from that day to this day in terms of seeing things get done, you know, positive things get done. We went to, I won't bore you with the travelogue, it was great for me, but I want to tell you one part of that trip. I went to one of the best AA meetings I ever went to in my whole life in a jail in North Carolina. We went to a jail in Alexander, and that's one of those 100-man camps that somebody was talking about, Blue was talking about yesterday. So I had an AA meeting, and the three of us went to this meeting. There was 40 or 50 guys there. I think it had something to do with visitors coming or something like that. But it was an incredible meeting. It was just unbelievable. There was one of the inmates chaired the meeting, and he started the meeting, and he sat down, and they went through the preamble and the steps and all that kind of stuff, and they just sat there. Nobody said anything. I started to get edgy. God, somebody got to say something here. Like, somebody's got to be pointing the finger. Didn't do it. Some young guy was sitting up near the chairman, and he started to kind of whine and snivel a bit about nobody loved him anymore, and, you know, and it was this person's fault and that person's fault. And there was some guy down in the back of the room, and his voice came right from his toes. Hi. My name is Bo. My name is Bo, and I'm an alcoholic. And he told that guy in the kindest words and yet strong recovery words that he was his own problem. A couple other people spoke, and this guy kind of did it again. A couple of people spoke, and then there was this voice in the back of the room. I'm still Bo, and I'm still an alcoholic. And he did it again, only with a little bit more conviction, but in an AA manner. It was in a helpful manner. It wasn't a put-down deal. A couple other people spoke. You know what we're like, right? He did it again. A couple other people spoke. It was kind of going around like this. My name is still Bo. He delivered that message so well. And then the two sponsors were at the meeting. And they just sat off to the side for the whole meeting until about 5 minutes was left there. And then they just stepped in the neatest way I ever saw and just tied that whole thing together without being directive or without, you know, preaching or teaching or anything like that. They just took their experience as people, what got said at that meeting, and if that young guy didn't have that message when he walked out of there, he just didn't want it. I don't know what he got. I walked out of there feeling, woo, that was really quite a meeting. And that is one of the best meetings I've ever been to. I believe that a lot of things are happening here. You know, Bill Wilson used to talk about this thing. You know, we got to protect this thing. You know, Rob used that term the other night. You got a thing going here. I mean, it's incredible. I don't see this home. I wish I did. Maybe someday we will, but I don't see the level of commitment home that I see. You don't see so many people trying so hard, you know. We got a lot of guys doing time because of what they are. And I see a lot of people trying to become what they're supposed to be by helping them, you know. One thing, two more things I'll say, and then I really will be quiet. There are two stories. Sometimes I heard of a lot of people this weekend, you know, sometimes it feels like you're not doing anything, you know, because you don't see the results that you really want to see, you know. And I have a young guy that I'm sponsoring right now, and one of the things I do, I'm like blue in a way. Somebody smarter than me said, Mike, you can't do this kind of work because you're going to get your agenda mixed up, and they're going to get their agendas mixed up. Okay, so you do what you do in the community. What I tend to do a little bit these days is I work with a fair amount of guys on steps. I do a lot of that work. And I have a young guy who's generally people, not honestly not because of me, but generally guys tend to do pretty well when they apply themselves that way. And I get this one young guy I've been working with for a year and a half who called me the other night, and he told me he was resigning from AA. And I thought, are you joining the Rotary or what? And God love him, you know, he's going to die. You know, he just can't let it go. And maybe he won't, you know. Maybe God's got another plan or whatever's going to work out for him. Part of my recovery needs to be that I am the pipe and not the well. The messenger and not the message. I got to do the best that I can do and allow God to do what God does best. And that's what you got to do, you know. Hear a lot of guys, you know, talking about just worried that they wish they could do more. And that's a noble, wonderful thought. It really is. It's a tremendous thought. But I don't know if you've heard this story. I think it's a tremendous story. If you've heard it, bear with me, okay? But it's a little moral to the story. There was about a guy was walking along the beach one day, and he kind of looked ahead, and he saw somebody up ahead. The person would kind of skip couple of towards the water, and then he'd kind of throw something. Then he'd go back and he'd skip and he'd throw something. And then he'd skip and he'd throw something. And guy come up and he there was a young guy there, and he said, "What are you doing?" The beach was all littered with starfish that had been washed up in the tide. And he said, "What are you doing?" He says, "Well, I'm throwing the starfish back so that they'll live." He said, "You're a fool. Don't you understand that nature has its own design, that they're supposed to die? Because that's just the way they are. They're supposed to die. And you're being a fool." And the guy picked one up, and he walked to the water, and he threw it in. And he said, "Well, that one won't die today." And that's the way we have to do it in AA, I'm convinced. Stevie, my buddy, may drink tomorrow. May drink today. May be drinking now. My responsibility is to give the best that I can to him and let God do what God does with that. I've learned one more thing in Alcoholics Anonymous. I have learned that God loves me the way I am and not the way I think I'm supposed to be. And I was incapable of learning that in the seminary. And I was incapable of comprehending that on my own. I've come along in Alcoholics Anonymous enough to know that my trials, my tribulations, and my faults and my defects are all part of my recovery. And all those prayers about, I don't know if I mean this, God, it doesn't really matter. It doesn't really matter, as long as I'm trying my best. I'm just going to close with this one thing. I don't want to get too religious, but anyway, I will. This is not a religious program, but it's an interesting story, you know. You realize in the Gospel of Matthew, in the big book, there's a story about when John was in jail and he sent a couple of his followers to see Jesus, and they asked him, "Are you the one?" And he said, "Go back and tell what you've seen." And he said, "You know, what you see is the blind see, the lame walk. You know, the unclean are clean, and the dead live. You know, and when I go back to Moncton, I can tell them that I've been to Carolina, and the blind see, and the lame walk, you know, all because of people like you." And the very, very second last thing I want to say is, next week I'm speaking to a bunch of administrators. Tom's asked me to speak to some wardens and parole directors and that in over on the other side of the state. And I know what I want to say to them. I mean, you know, the idea is to see what they can do to help, you know. And I know what I want to say to them. But I want you to know, as a result of this conference, I'm pumped. I really know what I want to say to them. And what I want to say to them is they should thank their lucky stars to have the likes of you and the likes of this program in their jails to help them do the things they need to do. Thank you very, very much for the hospitality. Steve and everybody were just tremendous. It's just a thrill and an honor. Thank you very much.